May it please the court. My name is Adam Carter with the Employment Law Group, and I represent Dennis Glynn, the plaintiff and the appellant in this case. It's important to focus on what Mr. Glynn knew and when he knew it, what he knew at the time that he engaged in his whistleblowing. And in June and July of 2006, when Mr. Glynn blew the whistle, here's what he knew. He knew that for over a year, he had been complaining about low power on these devices at high temperatures. The power amps were blowing, and there was reduced range. And an analysis was done, and Glynn was right, and a fix was created. This temperature compensation pad was inserted into the jammer. And all the new jammers got the fix. But the 800 jammers that are out in the field, supposed to be protecting our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, where it's very hot, Mr. Glynn knew would not be working. They would be breaking. And he demanded a recall. He knew they would fail. And what he knew was the way IST reacted. IST said it would not recall these units. It did not want to upset the apple cart. And he knew that IST would not inform its customer. This was required by the contract. This all goes to his reasonable good faith belief. Charging for a flawed product, a dysfunctional product, is wrong and against the law.
Was there anything in the record that reflected that this product, the scan, whatever you call jammers, that they were ever not produced, did not meet the contract specifications?
I'm glad you asked that. There is a contract specification. This is at the JA at page 300, and it has to do with reliability and maintainability, 3.5.1 of the contract. And it says, IST shall notify the government of any and all performance-related data that would both positively and negatively impact the reliability, maintainability, availability, and or supportability of the MMBJ system. This means that they had an obligation.
Did you ever allege below or argue on brief that they failed to meet the specifications in the contract for performance?
We did allege that, and what we were saying was that all of his complaints to management and then later to the government had to do with the unavailability of this system at temperature in the E band, and that there was this reduction in power. This was well known throughout the company.
That violated the specifications of the contract.
Yes, because the contract requires that you inform the customer of any reduction in what the jammer can do. If the troops know that it can jam out to say 1,000 yards, and then there's a 9% reduction, they're going to come to rely on it at 1,000 yards, not at 900, for example. So the point is that the government wants to know about any lack of availability, any negative performance, and he didn't tell them. And this heightened Mr. Glynn's, heightened his awareness of what was going on. And the apple cart comment is very telling. It could mean two things.
We're talking about the same thing. There seems to be, at least in my mind, a difference between something that's dysfunctional and something that can be improved. Did Glynn have evidence that these systems had, in fact, failed?
Yes.
Where is that evidence?
It's what leads up to the creation of the temperature compensation pad. All of that engineering and testing that went into that was something that Glynn had been saying throughout the company for a year. And in June, they changed the design, and they put in this temperature compensation pad. This has been admitted in the record. And what they wouldn't do, though, is go change the ones that were out in the field. This isn't an improvement. This is because at temperature, these things are blowing. They're breaking. They're low in power output.
Evidence of that.
Yes, he had performed the tests, and that was all presented to the judge at summary judgment. The judge just went past it.
I thought the government brought some of those in and they tested them and they all passed.
Now, I'm glad you raised that. So chronologically, I was in June and July. Later, what Glynn knows after they won't recall, after they won't upset the apple cart, after...
They pass or not.
And in October, when Glynn went to the government, the colonel in charge called for testing. And when they did the testing, they gave them the ones with the temperature pad. And they passed, not surprisingly. And then Mr. Glynn, cooperating with the government, said, no, you tested the wrong ones. Make him recall some from the field. And then they did. And when they recalled them from the field, lo and behold, there were some failures, as expected.
Well,
so
did they meet the contract specifications?
No, they did not, because
SOCOM said a 9% reduction was fine with them.
Well, that's really not important, because what's important is what Mr. Glynn knows at the time of his whistleblowing. It's never important on a False Claims Act whistleblower case whether the government actually brings a case or does or doesn't. It's totally beside the point.
It would be important if the product they produce met the contract, even though Mr. Glynn may have thought it could have been better and that it should have been better to protect the troops, if the product they were producing met the contract specifications of the government, it's hard for me to see how there's a particular fraud. Now, I'm still waiting for a specific description of, at this point in time, the contract required X, and the manufacturer didn't give them X.
The contract required that, and I read it to Your Honor, the contract required that IST give notice of any reduction in availability of the product. And there's admission. There's a 30B6 testimony admission that this would be a 9% reduction in power. That means that the protective bubble was not as large as it should be. That is a reduction in the availability. That's a contract violation, and Mr. Glynn explained it. He stuck out his neck to be put to have it on the chopping block.
Right, we'll assume that. I'm confused based on your answer to Judge Gregory. I thought also that the government said the 9% was okay. Is that wrong?
The government did this testing, saw that there were some failures, and then we know that after that, okay. Remember, most of this is classified, so we weren't allowed to get into it.
Wait a minute. Is in response to Judge Gregory's question on the 9%, is that within the contract specifications or not?
I say no.
It's not. Okay.
And again, because it's a reduction, they weren't telling the customer about.
I say no, but you weren't the customer. SOCOM said it was okay with them. Did they not? Don't tell me whether or not it's relevant. Just didn't they say that 9% was fine?
I know that they went along and continued to be their customer. That's all I know. It was all classified. We weren't allowed to get into it in discovery. That's all I know, Your Honor.
Okay.
And
so,
I.
So we're running into probably a difference, at least with understanding here, because it seems that you are focusing entirely on what you say Glynn knew, and it doesn't matter if the objective evidence shows something different. But it at least shows that when these systems, they did in fact pull back systems and tested them. And they passed, didn't they?
No, sir. The ones that they pulled back from the field failed.
Every one of them failed.
No, sir. Not all.
Show me the place in the record where it shows that they failed.
Not every single one of them failed in the record.
I thought the investigators told Glynn that the test, that they had passed tests.
The first batch did all pass. These were the ones that had the fix. The second batch, after Mr. Glynn, again, cooperating with the government, advising the government behind the scenes, was telling them that they didn't pull the ones from the field, that didn't have the fix. So then Colonel Grigsby went and pulled some from the field, and there was a reduction, and I'll find that for Your Honor in just a moment. Maybe I'll bring that back on.
And explain that, because, see, these pads seem to be there to improve the output, but is there any indication of a failure?
Yes. The system, as is, failed at 65C. That's the JA at 714.
Which system?
The system, the whole system. This thing is like the size of a computer server, and it goes into the bottom of the Humvee. And there are various parts to the system, but one of them is the module that Glynn has invented. that's part of this system. There are other parts to it as well, but the system failed. And we've got a 30B6 admission that's the case. My point is simply, this is stuff that a jury should be allowed to consider. Mr. Glynn is reasonable in good faith. He's the inventor of this thing. He should know what it can and can't do. And he's sticking out his neck both to management and then quintessentially goes to the government.
When you say the system failed, is that the government's testing information or is that the information of your client?
This was the company's testing that was done.
Wasn't there government testing?
The government tested later in October.
What did the government test show?
And the government tests show the first nine they brought back, all passed, those were the ones that had the temperature compensation pad. Then when Colonel Grigsby...
So all those passed.
Yes, sir.
Didn't they tell Mr. Glynn that?
Yes, they did. And then that's when Mr. Glynn says, you didn't test the ones from the field. And so he asked them to, and Colonel Grigsby sent away... And there was further testing October 20th. This, by the way, is already after they've decided to terminate Glynn. October 20th, they test, and several of them failed. Indeed, the power amplifiers had blown completely. Without a power amplifier, the thing will look like it's on, but it's not
and
jamming.
The government's testing information that you're saying.
The government and...
The failures is government testing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And Mr. Glynn testified about that at the hearing. On the PI, but again, this is the stuff that in my view the trial judge just went past, and what is, to my way of thinking, very important is what Glynn knew, and he knew this was a problem, and he raised it to government agents. The company knew that. They described him as a whistleblower because they self-report, and how can you be a whistleblower if you haven't already engaged in protected activity? So they know that he's done that. They know that he's done the sticking out of his neck. That's the main thing. And then they you look at the timing of that. September 11th is when he wants to change his... They want to give him a stay pay agreement. By the way, why do you offer an employee who's substandard, one of the top 10%, a stay pay agreement? And on September 11th, he tells them he wants to change the at-will relationship to make it a for-cause termination. That predicts litigation. And then the next day, they take away his management responsibilities. And the next day, the day after that, on the 13th, he makes his initial contact with the government. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Miazzi? Mielsi.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, William Mielsi for the appellee, EDO Corporation and Impact Science Technology. Judge Motz.
Before you start, at least I have an initial concern, and that is, opposing counsel is unequivocal that there was government evidence, at least I understand to say, shows these systems failed. And that was just out there. There was a first batch, nine, that it all passed, but then they failed and didn't pull them back in. How do you respond to that? Was that, in fact, what the record reflects?
No, Your Honor, the record does not reflect that. And just to one of the more specific questions that was asked concerning a failure of one of these modules at below or above 65 centigrade. I may have the technology wrong. Footnote 11 of Judge Motz's opinion is extensive. It goes over onto two pages. He discusses this whole issue where he is examining evidence in the record concerning company testing that was performed on certain modules, not the entire system. Every system is tested and passed before it's shipped to the government.
I thought I heard him say that the system failed.
And that's in those.
Did you not hear that?
You did hear that.
And you said that's not true.
That's not an accurate statement of the record.
How can that be? One lawyer will stand up and say, we've been dealing with this today. How can one lawyer stand up and say the system failed? And the other says, no, the record shows it. That's not true.
And in candor and in spirit of generosity, I think
I don't want your generosity.
No, I understand. I think you can, and this is why I point you directly to Judge Motz's footnote 11. He examines this question, and he examines the testimony that he concluded, I think quite accurately, was taken out of context. And when the testimony and the testing results are read in context, what is referred to as a failure was a pre-shipped product, a component of that product did not pass the test, but that component was then upgraded or improved or replaced, whatever they did, before the mobile multi-band jammer was shipped to the Army or to Iraq where it went. So that is the footnote is extensive and recites the record in extraordinary detail. So, but to answer your question, put it this way, it's a misreading of the evidence to suggest that the failure of one of these modules, which is a part of the device, failed. That was not an uncommon occurrence in the process of assembling these devices. As they were assembled, they were tested, and then the entire unit, once it was assembled, was tested in order to meet IST specifications and the government's specifications. There is no evidence in the record that any of these units failed. The ones that were recalled and tested by the government, all of them passed. And the government investigator, Agent Hochberger.
That seems to be a complete contradiction, at least is what I thought that I heard from opposing counsel, that there was some subset that was recalled from overseas and the government tested those and they failed. That's what I understood counsel to say. Maybe I misunderstood him.
I don't know where in the record that evidence exists, Your Honor. The first of all, we're dealing with a product that was evolving. It was a cutting edge technology, and the first units were subsequently upgraded and improved so that their performance in the field, as well as the protective bubble, expanded as they improved the technology and had field field experience with these. So there's multiple iterations of the device. But those that were recalled as a consequence of the appellant's concern, as a principal engineer, that is his job. His job was to question the reliability and the performance of these devices, which he was involved designing, and he was responsible for testing. Interestingly, I believe it's in May 2006, when Mr. Glynn directs one of the assemblers, one of his subordinates, to pass some of these modules at a temperature that is not provided in the specifications in order to speed up the production process. Those products were later recalled and tested. As soon as IST management learned that Mr. Glynn had disregarded these testing protocols, they reported to the Special Operations Command. They reported to the customer that there was a problem and there was a concern, put it that way, that some of these units had not had shipped and not met their specifications. There was a recall. They were tested, and every single one of them passed. Agent Hochberger, who is the investigator, issues an email or a memo on November 8th, 2006, where he's expressing several, I think, very important, very material points in the case. One, all the units passed, and B, the employer, Impact Science Technology, has no knowledge that the government has any interest or that they're investigating any potential claim of fraud. They self-reported, and they had, as far as they know, all of their devices were operating as designed.
Where
where is this reference to 9% reduction either being permissible or not?
I couldn't give you the precise record citation, but I believe it's my understanding of it, Judge, is that it is the detailed explanation, which is going to be more comprehensive than I'm going to provide, is in footnote 11 of the lower court's opinion. I believe this differential was within products, was within the contract specifications, but if I may, importantly, Mr. Glenn never saw these contract specifications. He was offered the opportunity to see the contract specifications, but he never went ahead and did that. So he cannot have an objectively reasonable basis to assert a failure to comply with those specifications. And obviously as Owens and Mann, the Mann cases in this court have instructed, you have to do more to present a claim as a whistleblower under the False Claims Act than to complain to your supervisors, to your management, that there may be defects, there may be problems. There has to be a distinct possibility that you are pursuing or investigating a QI-TAM action. And at no point, certainly up to September 13, 2006, at no point is there any evidence that the appellant in this case was pursuing or engaging in any conduct that led to a distinct possibility of a QI-TAM claim. In fact, his testimony disavows any claim that his employer was engaged in fraud or billing the government or making false certifications as to this product. Now, and you can draw a line right there. You can draw a line in September 13, 2006, because at that point, indisputably, he's put himself in the position, I should say, of initiating a potential QI-TAM claim. But in Judge Motz at page 24 of his opinion addresses that very, very clearly. By that time, though, it was objectively unreasonable for the appellant to believe that the contentions that he made were accurate. And the contentions that he made were that these products shipped and were faulty, and that the company had made false certifications as to the quality assurance, or the compliance with the quality assurance program, and that there had been false billings associated with that. As of that date, September 13, 2006, and Mr. Glenn knew this, each of these products had been tested, and a sample had been recalled. Every single one of them passed. He had no knowledge of the provisions of the contract because he didn't avail himself of the opportunity to review the specifications. And at no time prior to this had he ever asserted to his management even a concern that there was fraud or there was any failure to comply with the representations or the quality assurances that they were bound to under the contract with the government.
Had he gone outside the chain of command before that time?
No, I don't believe he had. He had reported to his management, his chain of command.
I mean, outside to the government, to the investigators.
No, there's no evidence of that, Judge, at all until September 13, 2006, when he contacts the U.S. Attorney's Office. And at that point, as I said, clearly he gains that protective status. But as Judge Motz does in what is in an exhaustive opinion, studded with citations to the record, I wasn't at the lower court proceeding. I inherited this one on appeal, which is not normal for me, but that's the way this one came to me. And his opinion was very helpful to me, just to prepare myself to help write the briefs and then give this argument. Because rarely does a busy federal trial judge have the time to write a 75-page opinion, 36 pages of which are devoted to this claim on appeal. He examines each and every element of the claim, of the element of the False Claims Act whistleblower claim. He weighs the evidence in a light as favorable as he can to the appellant in this case, and he concludes on separate and independent grounds. One, the appellant didn't engage in any protected activity.
Now, Mr. Carter didn't talk about this when it first came up, but what about the question of quality assurance plan? Was it not a fact question as whether or not that was required to be in writing and formalized, and that was a part of his complaint clearly when he went outside to the U.S. attorney?
That's correct. There was, as part of the contract, it was required that a quality assurance program be implemented. The short answer to your question is Mr. Glenn had no competent evidence that there wasn't such a quality assurance program in place and in compliance with the contract as of the time it was expected, and certainly before the time he went to the U.S. attorney in September 2006. And the evidence for that is, one, he admitted he'd never seen the quality assurance program. Two, he provided a template of a quality assurance program to one of his colleagues who was tasked with drafting the program. And three, he said he saw what appeared to be parts of this quality assurance program left on a copy machine. That's the record evidence as to what Mr. Glenn knew about the existence or non-existence of a quality assurance program.
But that was enough evidence, at least a factual question, of whether or not that was deficient, and therefore a reasonable suspicion that there wasn't a formalized plan and that was in violation of the contract. He had, as he used the word, stuck his neck out going to the authorities to make that a part of his complaint. Why is that not a factual question, whether or not QTAM could have been based on that aspect of it?
Well, if first, I think Judge Motz correctly examined that and determined it was based upon his speculation. It wasn't competent evidence that there was not such a quality assurance program. Two, he had the opportunity. He was offered the opportunity to examine the contract specifications, and he never ever took the opportunity to do that. In fact, I don't believe it was until the litigation was commenced and there was discovery that any of that was ever. And he admitted that in his deposition, that he'd ever seen it before. So in the course of time, as he's making this complaint to the government concerning the product, he has no credible evidence. He's got no competent evidence, what I should say, that there wasn't such a program in place. The company testified that there was such a program in place as the contract specified.
In this record, there's based upon the transmissions between SOCOM and IST, it seemed like they were referencing the insufficiency of the plans, that this is, if you call this a plan, it seems to be inadequate. I would think they have more than something just in progress. It seemed to me that those missives would suggest that those are the facts, that that's a viable question.
The question is, the examination, at least as I read and understand the opinion in Mann, is what did the employee know at the time he made his complaint in pursuit of a potential QTAM claim? And at the time the employee made the complaint, he had no knowledge. He had no competent knowledge that this quality assurance program was either in place or insufficient or anything of the kind. He wasn't responsible for drafting it. When he was given the opportunity to examine the contract documents, he didn't take that opportunity. So you're left with speculation.
So he gets no credit for suspecting correctly?
In that instance, to answer the question directly, no, I guess you don't. Because this is, it's not an objectively reasonable contention on his part. He didn't have the basis to which to make that complaint. And he had not been raising these issues with his management. I give you an example, if I can answer it a little differently. If at the time, say August or July 2006, he had gone to his management and said, I want to see the contract specifications because I don't think that our quality assurance program is up to the contract requirements or we're not in compliance, and he was denied then clearly I think you've got a different, we've got a very different case. But that's not the record in the case. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miyoshi.
Thank you.
Mr. Carter, you've reserved some time.
Yes, thank you. Let me address these in order. Footnote 11 of Judge Ma's opinion, page 15 of his opinion, does indeed say what I said it said, which is that the system has failed at 65 degrees C. And the upshot of Judge Motz's opinion is, as IST's counsel has stated during the motions hearing, that rework process is producibility. And Your Honor, what is going on here is Judge Motz substituting his view for what this data means instead of Mr. Glynn's knowledge of the system. Now let's move on quickly to October 20th.
Stop you there for just a second.
All right.
As I've quickly read through this footnote again, it looks like the Judge Motz has distinguished between the different segments, the different bands, A, B, E, F, and that when he uses the term system, he uses it only as to that particular band, not to all of them.
Again, it's a failure of the contract term not to tell the government about this. And we know from the record that they did not.
So it's not the whole machine that fails, it's just the one segment.
And again,
it might not have performed up to the degree specification.
Correct. And that my point is that a jury can look at that and can say that that is a failure that should have been told to the government. On the October 20th, Your Honor asked that question about the about that. I refer you to page... you'll bear with me. Page 14 of my opening brief. On October 20th, 9 units were tested. All of them failed because of low output power, reduced range. I cite to 320 to 23 of the JA and 765. Even IST's own Scott Traurig, the guy who's in charge. 320 to 323 and page 765. And Mr. Traurig, his testimony was that two of the amplifiers failed. By the way, if an amplifier fails, that means the thing is broken. It's not working at all. And when heated, the systems had certain frequencies that did not meet the room temperature criteria, and he admitted that inadequate power on the E-band means the system cannot perform its mission as designed in the E-band. This is the head guy, Mr. Traurig. That's JA 344 to 345. And he clarified that this means, quote, soldiers could be, or other users, not necessarily soldiers, could be killed or injured, page 335. Then Mr. Miyoshi talks about my client's own testimony. I think my reply brief does, if I may say, a good job of saying how they took those statements out of context about what he was complaining, whether IST was doing something wrong. This goes to Judge Gregory's question about the quality assurance. He didn't know who was to blame. Was it IST for not having a quality assurance program, or was it for the government for not discovering it? That's what that was about. I was definitely complaining that the results were systems that would put our troops in harm's way. That's at JA 4439 and 340.
Mr. Glynn ever asked to see the quality assurance plan?
He asked to see the contracts. And he was refused those contracts. And that is also Mr.
I thought they were gonna let him see the specifications, just not the pricing part.
He had the specifications already. What he didn't have is he didn't have all the contract terms like the ones that we're talking about today about performance and quality assurance. But and this is, I think,
is there a place in the record where you can point to where he asked specifically to see a quality assurance plan?
No, I cannot. He asked to see the contracts, but what he knew, and what I think this goes to his reasonable good faith belief, 26 years of experience, president of another company that IST gobbled up, that contracts with the government. He knows that quality assurance is required in these contracts. He has seen them. He's seen these contract requirements before. He knows it's in there. And guess what? He was right. And so he goes to the government and he explains, we don't have a quality assurance program. And what is his good faith belief? He's there. He works there. He knows they don't have one. Dan Rice confirmed that. Mickey Lincoln confirmed that. Other witnesses all confirmed that there was no quality assurance. The head of the company, Murin, said probably not. That was his testimony. Outside the chain of command, Your Honor asked, going around your supervisors, going out of your chain of command, the Williams case from the D.C. Circuit says that that could be, that that is, that puts the company on notice that you are engaging in protected activity and puts them on notice of litigation. What you've got here is you've got him going to Caprario. Caprario says, I won't recall. Don't want to upset the apple cart. He goes to DocMo. He goes to DocMo and says, my people aren't sleeping at night. And DocMo's got notes of this. And DocMo is the head of the company. He's now two levels up above his supervisor. He goes to Puzzo, one level above his supervisor, and asks for the contracts. No. So, Mr. Miyoshi, I commend him. He conceded that as of September 13th, my client has engaged in protected activity. Well, he's not terminated until December. The adverse action happens after he's engaged in protected activity. And most importantly, what has happened between September 13th, when he goes to the government, and October the 13th, when they make the decision to terminate him? I've got that in the record as well. There's nothing. There is no evidence of Mr. Glynn doing any bad behavior, Mr. Glynn doing anything at all, except asking for an at-will part of his contract to be taken out, which is litigation, and they've taken away his management responsibilities, and they find out that he's gone to the government. Those are the three things that have happened between September 13th and October 13th. Oh, I forget one other. And Colonel Grigsby has come in and wants to do some testing. And they've self-identified that they have a whistleblower, and they know it's Glynn. I notice I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We're going to come down and greet counsel and then take a short recess.
This honorable court will take a brief recess.